This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'm reading one of my favorite authors, Carl Safina, a book published in 2011, The View from Lazy Point, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World. Lazy Point is the far eastern end of Long Island. He goes month by month through the year and diverts to trips he's taken from Antarctica to the northern reaches of Sweden and to southeast Alaska, which is what I've been reading about. This is the third reading from this chapter. We are with Wade Loofborough, and Safina writes, Wade guides the 42-foot legend, and we head southward. Wade is a longtime resident for decades of southeast Alaska and has fished this area for decades. This chapter, called Travels Polar, Bear Witness, Southeast Alaska. The situation with logging here, too, is better than it's been. In 1900, Naval Officer George T. Emmons described Southeast Alaska to Theodore Roosevelt as one immense forest of conifers. Once upon a planet, the largest treed, densest forests in the world stood from Northern California through Southeast Alaska, and they, perhaps more than anything, delineated the Pacific Northwest. The world's other temperate rainforests can quickly be summarized. A tiny bit on the Black Sea, long gone. A tiny amount in Ireland and Scotland, long gone. Tiny areas in Iceland, oddly enough, and long gone. A little in Norway, remnants remain. And western Patagonia, smaller. Temperate rainforests on the west coast of New Zealand and in Tasmania are shrunken and riddled with invasive species. Chile has significant tracts left, though their flora and fauna are very different. And that's it. British Columbia has been sliced to ribbons, and south of the Canadian border, saws have felled 95% of the original forests. Southeast Alaska holds half of the original Pacific Northwest forest area and about a third of the world's remaining temperate rainforest. But as we travel north of Tenaki Inlet, the clouds pull their skirts up on jaw-dropping clear cuts, spread along Admiralty Island's west coast, and Chichagof Island's plush and solemn forests give way to broad swaths of gray stumps and dirt running for miles along northern Chatham Strait. This is corporate logging. After years of fighting over encroachment on native land, the Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971 awarded Alaska's original peoples about 12% of Alaska, but it canceled native land titles and created native corporations instead, meaning native individuals own not land, but shares of corporate stock. Like all other corporations, native corporations must maximize profit. Turning trees into corporate cash greatly increased natives' monetary wealth, but radically changed their relationships with family, community, land, and wildlife. Native corporations own less than 5% of the land in Southeast, but they're responsible for half of the clear-cutting here. The other half? After World War II, the U.S. Congress wanted to keep a rebuilding Japan away from the Soviet Union and lure it to Alaskan wood, so it guaranteed an immense quantity of timber to two pulp mills, one Japanese-owned, which monopolized the region's logging from the 1950s until the late 1990s. Massive taxpayer subsidies let them cut a centuries-old tree from public land for the price of a cheeseburger. Many trees were pulped to make cellophane, rayon, and throwaway diapers. Right over there in Hoonah, says Wade, pointing, for years and years, there was always a Japanese ship loading whole logs crane load after crane load after crane load. That's where this whole forest went, unquote. Alarmed communities who didn't want their forests and salmon streams turned into mud finally banded together with conservation groups and went after the subsidies. They campaigned for years. In 1990, the Tongass Timber Reform Act killed the guaranteed timber cut and subsidy. It saved 1 million acres of prime forest and world-class fish streams, including Annan Creek, which was scheduled for clear-cutting. Plus, it saved the bears, eagles, deer, hunting, fishing, rational logging, and everything else that comes with them. Most of these clear-cuts we're looking at are 10 to 20 years old, but the short summers here slow regrowth. John Muir counted the rings in a hemlock here that was only 20 inches in diameter and 540 years old. Only 5% of the region has been clear-cut, but because of ice, rock, and quirks of drainage, only 4% of the Tongass is capable of supporting truly giant trees. Loggers cut the biggest, the oldest, those stands that were the most important to wildlife. The government still spends about $30 million annually auctioning federal timber to private loggers. Bids bring in about $750,000. A $29,250,000 loss to taxpayers. Author Douglas Chadwick writes, dividing that by 200 Tongass timber jobs, the government could pay each logger and mill worker $146,250 a year to stay home and let the forest be, unquote. But hear this, the major clear cutting is past. A lot of forest remains, at least for now. The corporations and the massive taxpayer-funded, congressionally-pumped, market-distorting corporate subsidies have, like a threatening fever, largely run their course. Weakened by their own overreaching, they've given way to more rational practices. This region, seemingly so wild, has actually been recovering from massive logging and overfishing. I hope it can stay on track. The region remains very much in transition toward whatever will come next. And what's coming mainly is tourism. Nowadays, the 200 people employed by the region's 13 sawmills make up less than 1% of Southeast's total employment. Meanwhile, gigantic cruise ships, each employing 1,000 workers, bring people who want to see forested slopes. In Ketchikan alone, population 8,000, cruise ships dislodge 800,000 passengers whose shopping sprees generate $120 million. When I ask Wade where he sees the future headed, he says, Juneau has transitioned to tourism. Wrangell has transitioned to fishing and tourism. Ketchikan is still carrying a grudge, unquote. Some people don't want one more log taken out, but there's room for small operators. Some former clear cuts have dense second growth where thinning would benefit wildlife. These communities helped protect these forests. Now environmentalists should ask them, what are your dreams for the future? Point Adolphus brings a sea change and a change of air. The mouth of Glacier Bay exhales chilly breath, wrapping the shores in a misty taffeta gown. Cloud-piercing peaks gleam in shafts of light. It's a dynamic, many-paneled sky, by turns somber and spectacular. Heavily timbered shores rise so steep they practically leap skyward. The place feels new again. Icy Strait is mainly about absorbing injected energy from the nearby ocean. The chart warns that tidal currents may attain velocities of 8 or 10 knots. Absolutely true. A manic tide is pushing roiling rivers of ocean water through the strait. Ocean-powered currents create lush plankton pastures, turning the water jade. Tiny zooplankton graze the single-celled drifting grass. Swarms of small fishes reap the grazers. Whales, sea lions, and birds exploit the fish swarms, and we take it all in. The main hot spot, well marked by seabirds, is a seafloor hill of gravelly rubble plowed into place when the glaciers of Glacier Bay extended this far. That hill is about half a mile wide and underwater runs out a couple of miles from shore, with the tide forcing deep water over the drowned moraine. Surface currents churn as if they're boiling. The squeeze concentrates everything, thickening the broth. If you think like a hungry fish, your thoughts take you to this soup kitchen. Herring dimple the surface like raindrops. Even by Alaskan standards, this area seems supercharged with life. Flying birds crowd the air. Kittiwakes, Bonaparte's gulls, yellow-legged mew gulls, scarlet-legged pigeon guillemots, diving birds called marbled murrelets, chase fishes by flying underwater. To get airborne, they leap up and then bounce off the water while whirring their wings. In California, Oregon, and Washington, where 95% of the original nesting forests were cut down, marbled murrelets declined 80% in 20 years. Their population from California through Washington dropped to around 18,000 adults. Their population in Southeast Alaska, 680,000. That's why they're everywhere I look. Small swimming shorebirds called redneck phalaropes positively pepper the surface. When two predatory jaegers buzz in, the phalaropes rise in snaking lines that merge into smoke-like clouds. I estimate, it's hard to see the end of the flocks, perhaps 10,000 phalaropes. Flocks I've seen elsewhere had about a dozen birds. The world's largest sea lions, stellar sea lions, elsewhere in trouble, proliferate here. Their jaws dwarf a brown bear's. One surfaces with a salmon and a quick, skillful flip makes the fish vanish whole. And soon we sight so many whales, humpbacks, so close to shore that the sound of their breathing mingles with the chittering from eagles watching from towering trees. The whales' misty exhalations drift like little clouds against the forested slopes. In groups of six or eight, the herring-hounding whales plow through tide rips and along shoreline drop-offs. Gulls seeking injured fish fly around the whales and through their steamy spouts, dipping occasionally for a prize. Fluke, 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 fluke. Gliding shoulder to shoulder, the whales roll into their next dive and throw their tails skyward, the weight of their immense tail stalks driving them like pilings into the sea. For a few minutes, they vanish. John Muir. Think of the hearts of these whales beating warm against the sea, day and night, through dark and light, on and on for centuries. How the red blood must rush and gurgle in and out, bucketfuls, barrelfuls at a beat. Unquote. Blow, 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 abruptly surfacing whales shoot dense jets of breath, roaring their steamy exhalations loud enough to echo from the rocks in higher silences. Strangely, one trumpets almost elephant-like whenever it blows. For 2 hours, we watched one dense herd of about 15 humpbacks surfacing in unison and plunging to hunt the unfathomable tons of small fish they need. The sonar screen shows flecking from about 150 feet down to the bottom at around 300. Busted-up herring schools, Wade interprets. This is a long time for feeding whales to stay pressed against one small stretch of shore. Those herrings they've been working are probably shot to remnants. Occasionally, a distant breaching whale detonates a great explosion, the sound taking as long as 2 seconds to report like muffled cannon fire, Wade's assessment. Boy, this is some pile of whales. Whales aren't the only ones who have to eat. We drop a line with half a dozen shiny hooks, and in seconds, several herring come over the rail. Wade moves us to a secret spot. We anchor on a hill just 60 feet deep and drop a couple of fresh-caught fish to the seafloor. When we haven't had a bite in 5 minutes, Wade gets agitated. I'm thinking, Wade, we're fishing. Have patience. Just 5 minutes later, a fish comes knocking. Wade said this was a great spot for fish that are the right size for dinner, but he miscalculated. After a 10-minute struggle, we tie a 70-pound halibut to our stern cleat. In a world full of starving people, the herring themselves would have been sufficient blessing. Here in a few minutes, we traded a quarter-pound herring for months' worth of beautiful fish meat. The thick fillets gleam with pearly translucence, delicious simply to look at. If you figure, very conservatively, that only half the weight of the fish is muscle, and the rest is head, guts, bone, skin, fins, then we have 35 pounds of pure fillet, 70 half-pound meals, 140 quarter-pound servings. Wade will be rich in fish all winter. Our biggest daily decision for the rest of the trip will be fresh salmon or fresh halibut, grilled, fried, or baked. Our halibut is the biggest Wade's ever seen from this spot. In most other places, the biggest fish were caught long ago, but like I said, this is a place that still works. Wade's assessment, boy, that's some heap of meat. I'm spoiled, smitten. It didn't take long to feel this place capturing my soul. We anchor in a cozy, conifer-lined cove under a bowl of snow-draped peaks. I'm amazed to see so much snow in midsummer, but Wade's never seen so much bare rock up there. That's the value of having lived in a place. You have some idea of what's expected and what's unexpected. From those peaks, streams pour down corrugated, nearly vertical slopes before plunging into dense forests. The icy fingers of meltwater serve a wide emerald marsh and a shallow braided creek that runs to the tidewater. The large island that our map calls Admiralty has a more apt Tlingit name, Coots Nuwu, Forest of the Bears. So when I get my first good scan of shore, this is what I see. A flock of crows picking through the tide-lined rockweed, bent to their task like Van Gogh's potato planters. A brown bear lifts its head from the tall marsh grass. Suddenly two. The second has cubs, so four. Another bear with two cubs strides into view along the forest border. So seven grizzlies. This place bears brown bears at almost unimaginable densities, about one per square mile. The bears are so abundant because of beaches and mudflats full of shellfish, rivers that swell with salmon, and the general lushness the rain facilitates. Though the same species as grizzlies, these browns represent a distinct lineage believed to be descended from bears marooned between impenetrable ice sheets hundreds of thousands of years ago, bigger than interior grizzlies because of their salmon supplement and the longer foraging season, coastal browns attain weights exceeding 1,000 pounds. I sleep with a head full of dancing bears. Ursus Arctos once ruled from the Mississippi to the Pacific, and from Mexico to the Arctic tundra. They maintain their footing in parts of Russia and a tiny fraction of Europe and North America, though its visage stalks California's state flag. California's last grizzly was shot in 1922. Their final stronghold, Alaska. In Southeast, they live largely on three big islands, Admiralty, Baranof, and Chichagof, the ABC Islands, which harbor over 4,000 bears. Around the time of the last California grizzly, the Daily Alaska Empire editorialized, The brown bears ought to be exterminated at once. Then John Holdsworth's passionate 1930 book, The Wild Grizzlies of Alaska, sparked a national movement to protect Southeast Alaska's bears, and Admiralty's browns appeared saved. But in 1968, loggers planned to cut down 95% of Admiralty's trees. Even at 9 feet tall, the bears couldn't stand up for themselves. Litigation would decide whether the bears' fortress would fall. For a raging decade, lawsuits were lost, won, and appealed. In 1978, President Carter ended the debate by declaring Admiralty a national monument. 2 years later, Congress designated most of Admiralty as the Kootenai Wilderness. It took 50 years, but basically the bears won. Whenever cooler heads prevail and something has been saved, time always confirms the value of salvation and earns our thanks. Good morning. See any bears? Wade's on deck with a face towel and his toothbrush. Soon a dark grizz saunters onto the beach, trailing 3 cubs past half a dozen loafing eagles. One cub, a runty little thing, endearingly pathetic, is likely doomed. More than half of grizzly cubs die before their first birthday, and being the runt among siblings doesn't make for good odds. One bear per square mile is Admiralty's average density, but at this time of year, many bears move down to stalk salmon, making the lowland densities much higher. The bears have come, but unlike at Annan Creek, the salmon here are late, still sparse. That might mean hungry, edgy Bruins. This is a good, safe vantage. All of the most experienced people I've spoken to, and I'm talking about guides and biologists, people less afraid of bears than of traffic, have at one time or another felt the need to raise a loaded rifle at a threatening bear. We have no rifle, nor could we have a better defense than the boat and binoculars. But we decide, and I cannot help feeling that this is foolish, I mean there are a lot of bears with cubs, to go ashore. A few days ago I declined to go ashore on a very pretty island when Wade mentioned that it was free of bears. No bears? What was the point? The on-edge feeling of being in bear country has become, well, I don't want to say addictive. When I mentioned this later to a local, he didn't say something like, "You're naive, they're dangerous." He said, "Yeah, you want to know there are some bears around." Well, yeah, that's what I want to know. And so, into a light drizzle, I'm carrying a heavy-duty can of pepper spray, my fly rod, and a lot of trepidation. Pepper spray isn't foolproof, nor are guns. And because the canister costs about $50, we have no spares, so I've never practiced firing it. All across the exposed tidal flats, I see little jets of water squirting. The flats are loaded with clams. At the mouth of the river, I notice small packs of newly arriving salmon, 6 to a few dozen fish in each, gliding in. This is a short stream, so these are pinks. We walk past. Grizz tracks are everywhere in the sand. I soon notice that as a rose by any name smells sweet, this monumental island smells like bears. Their trail at the edge of the forest is well-worn and wide. This is no vaguely visible game trail. It's a bear road. Imagine a well-used horse-riding trail. That's how much bear scat. The scat is full of blueberries, which grow luxuriantly to heights over our heads. There's a lot of close cover. A bear could appear from anywhere. Their trails network the whole forest. Brown bears so thoroughly pervade the mists and shadows that the silence virtually hums with their presence. There's no need for Bigfoot. The brown bear is all the monster you could want. I'm out of my element. Wade's the guy experienced in brown bear country. Sheepishly, I admit, this seems a bit stupid. I await Wade's reassurance. Yeah, he says instead, this is kind of on the ragged edge of that word. I start calling, "Hey, bears, hi-ho." Bears don't like surprises, but nothing guarantees that an alerted bear will choose to slink off. Some bears have pride, others have cubs. Maybe a bear has just walked by, but her cubs are 50 yards behind her when we show up between them. "Hey, bears, hi-ho, tasty white meat here." The thick wilderness silence quickly absorbs our calls. If anything can be simultaneously awe-inspiring and nerve-wracking, this is. Two planes and a helicopter suddenly overfly the creek, shattering the aura. Wade's radio informs us that they're searching for a float plane, missing since yesterday, a father and son, friends of Wade's. Fog soon suspends their search and the sound of engines fades. And when the aura of wilderness returns, it clamps down on me. This is no movie set. It's a big primal place that can still swallow people whole, even people who come to penetrate with all the backup of modern civilization. We walk in about a mile, easy walk mostly along the bank, but Wade is quiet now. I leave him to his thoughts and walk ahead alone. All along the shore, all since the last high tide, bear tracks. One set tells of a female with cubs walking upstream this morning, just as I am. Her front prints dwarf my fist. I look up frequently to call out my presence and scan around. The sedges in the estuary are tall enough to hide bears easily, but right now they're beaded with dew and bent into cowlicks. So my view, and the bears, is pretty good here. The main channel is only about 50 feet wide with steep gravel sides and hairpin meanders. At a bend, where a smaller creek enters the main stream, quite a few salmon are holding in the lazy current. An occasional fish leaps, probably just hyped on its own pent-up energy. If such fish harbor some deep inkling that the end is nigh, but what can they feel and what can they know? You can get so close sometimes and still yearn for contact and a route in. Lacking any superior way to plumb their inner depths, I resort somewhat dumbly to the familiar. I strip some line and begin waving my fly rod in the air as I step into the water, then let the fly enter the flow. Certainly many fish see the drifting lure. Three casts. Five. I'm casting in front of, alongside, and amid dozens of fish. They entirely ignore my offerings. I cast again and again. I cast for over an hour. This is the most fish I never caught. Eating is not on their agenda. If a salmon can point upstream without thinking much about it, so can a man cast. Trouble with bears is often about mutual surprises. It's easy to get absorbed in something at the water's edge, especially when you've skidded down a steep gravel bank on a bear trail to watch fish. A friend of mine once hooked a salmon, got momentarily distracted, and when he refocused on the fish at the end of his line, it was in a bear's mouth. I keep telling myself that driving a car is more dangerous than standing here, but the danger of an unseen predator in unfamiliar terrain, in its terrain, is more visceral and electric than knowing one risks a fender bender. This region's combination of modernity and primordial, facilitated by having enough room for people, seems ideal. We can't create this elsewhere, but we can value and retain it here, and we can take the lesson of it to any place where there's still contested space. Open space is never unpopulated. It's the room that people need to keep the world and themselves intact. Here among bear trails and pungent poop, I don't want trouble. Acknowledged, if I'd stayed on the boat, I'd be safer. For that matter, I'd be safer if I never left home. But we want to go places. We want to live. To live is to bear some risks, and to live here is to risk some bears. Ravens croak and dong in the dark surround of forest. Eagles whistle and chitter regal proclamations. The stream sings. An occasional salmon splashes, but the silence here is so big and enveloping and resonant that it casts a tone into the air, the way a silent room can have a tone. This place has a sky tone, a world tone, the music of the spheres. I want to see another bear, but not just for a thrill. The animals don't seek thrills. They get more than their share daily. When everything was real, thrills were cheap, and attention was the price of living. Wild things pay attention. They try to avoid trouble, but they don't shirk life. I try to avoid trouble, too, but the wild raises a level of alertness that feels alive inside me. It puts the bird back into my chest. What I really want, as always, a genuine moment, a shared glance, connection. People came into a world like this, rich, natural, but not without danger. The prospects for real trouble here are low, but the prospects for feeling alive are guaranteed. Many people are shadowed most dangerously by beasts of their own imaginations. Being here is real. That's why this silence, coiled and charged, speaks volumes. Too often we let fake things stalk us. Accept no substitutes for real experience, real friends, true love, and real bears. Either you set the bar high and keep striving, or you create a danger greater than any grizz sneaking up on you, letting real life sneak away. And that's the end of this chapter about Southeast Alaska. I'm reading from The View from Lazy Point, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World by Carl Safina, published in 2011. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.